Penguin Random House Audio presents Time and Chance by Sharon K. Penman. Read for you by Anne Flosnick. To Jill Davies. Again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favour to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. Ecclesiastes. Prologue. It began with a shipwreck on a bitter cold November eve in God's year 1120. The English king, Henry, son of William the Bastard, conqueror of England, lost his only lawfully begotten son in the sinking of the White Ship. In his despair, he named his daughter Maud, widow of the Holy Roman Emperor, as his heir. But his lords balked at being governed by a woman, and when the old king died, Maud's cousin Stephen seized the throne. Stephen was not feared by his lords, who dismissed him as a mild man, gentle and good, who did no justice. When the Empress Maud and her bastard brother Robert, the Earl of Gloucester, led an army onto English shores, many rallied to her cause. Even more served only themselves or the devil. Outlaws roamed the roads and barons became bandits, raising up stone castles by forced labour, emerging from these wolf lairs to raid towns and plunder the countryside. Women, pilgrims, priests, none were spared by the lawless and the damned. Because men feared to venture into the fields, the earth was not tilled, crops did not grow, and hunger stalked the land. In this wretched way did 19 years pass, years of suffering and anarchy, and people said openly that Christ and his saints slept. The Empress Maud failed in her attempt to reclaim her stolen crown, but by her marriage to Geoffrey, Count of Anjou, she had given birth to a son who vowed to recover his lost birthright. He called himself Henry Fitz-Empress, and men began to hope that he might deliver them from their misery. It was said that he was fortune's favourite. When that was reported to him, he said a man makes his own luck, and some thought that was blasphemy. He was only 19 when he stunned Christendom by wedding Eleanor, the beautiful and headstrong Duchess of Aquitaine, less than 2 months after she'd been freed from her marriage to the King of France. He then turned his gaze upon Stephen's unhappy realm. Within a 12-month he had forced Stephen to recognise him as the rightful heir, and it was agreed that Stephen would rule for the rest of his days, and then Henry would be king. In less than a year it came to pass. He was but 21 when he was crowned as the second Henry to rule England since the Conquest, and the people rejoiced, for he promised them justice and peace. Chapter 1. July 1156. Chinon Castle, Turenne, France. As the King of England crossed the inner bailey of Chinon Castle, his brother watched from an upper-story window and wished fervently that God would smite him dead. Geoffrey understood perfectly why Cain had slain Abel, the firstborn, the best-beloved. Harry was the firstborn, too. There were just 15 months between them, 15 miserable months. But because of them, Harry had gotten it all. England and Anjou and Normandy, and Geoffrey had naught but regrets and resentments and 3 wretched castles, castles he was now about to forfeit. He'd rebelled again, and again he'd failed. He was here at Chinon to submit to his brother, but he was not contrite, nor was he cowed. His heart sore, his spirit still rebellious, he began to stalk the chamber, feeling more wronged with every stride. Why should Harry have the whole loaf and he only crumbs? What had Harry ever been denied? Duke of Normandy at 17, Count of Anjou upon their father's sudden death the following year, King of England at 21, and, as if that were not more than enough for any mortal man, he was wed to a celebrated beauty, the Duchess of Aquitaine and former Queen of France. Had any other woman ever worn the crowns of both England and France? History had never interested Geoffrey much, but he doubted it. Eleanor always seemed to be defying the natural boundaries of womanhood, a royal rebel who was too clever by half and as willful as any man. But her vast domains and her seductive smile more than made up for any defects of character, and after her divorce from the French king, Geoffrey had attempted to claim this glittering prize, laying an ambush for her as she journeyed back to Aquitaine. It was not uncommon to abduct an heiress, then force her into marriage, and Geoffrey had been confident of success, sure too that he'd be able to tame her wild nature and make her into a proper wife, dutiful and submissive. It was not to be. Eleanor had evaded his ambush, reached safety in her own lands, and soon thereafter shocked all of Christendom by marrying Geoffrey's brother. Geoffrey had been bitterly disappointed by his failure to capture a queen, but it well nigh drove him crazy to think of her belonging to his brother, sharing her bed and her wealth with Harry, and of her own free will. Where was the justice or fairness in that? Geoffrey was more uneasy about facing his brother than he'd ever admit, and he spun around at the sound of the opening door. But it was not Harry. Their younger brother Will entered, followed by Thomas Becket, the king's elegant shadow. Geoffrey frowned at the sight of them. As far back as he could remember, Will had been Harry's lapdog, always taking his side. As for Becket, Geoffrey saw him as an outright enemy, the king's chancellor and closest confidant. He could expect no support from them, and well he knew it.
"I suppose you're here to gloat, Will, as Harry rubs my nose in it."
"No, I'm here to do you a favour, if you've the wits to heed me." The most cursory of glances revealed their kinship. All three brothers had the same high colouring and sturdy muscular build. Will's hair was redder, and he had far more freckles, but otherwise he and Geoffrey were mirror images of each other. Even their scowls were the same. "Harry's nerves are on the raw these days, and he's in no mood to put up with your blustering. So for your own sake, Geoff, watch your tongue."
"Poor Harry, my heart bleeds for his raw nerves. In truth, it does."
"Do you never tire of licking his arse, little brother? Or have you acquired a taste for it by now?" Colour seared Will's face.
"You're enough to make me believe those tales of babes switched at birth, for how could we ever have come from the same womb?" "Let him be, lad." Thomas Becket was regarding Geoffrey with chill distaste. "As a dog returneth to his vomit, so a fool returneth to his folly." "You stay out of this, priest." "But then," Geoffrey said with a sneer, "you are not a priest, are you? You hold the chancellorship, yet you balk at taking your holy vows. Now why is that?"
"I serve both my God and my king," Becket said evenly, "with all my heart. But you, Geoffrey Fitz-Empress, serve only Satan, even if you know it not."
Geoffrey had no chance to retort, for the door was opening again. A foreigner unfamiliar with England would not have taken the man in the doorway for the English king, for he scorned the trappings of kingship, the rich silks and gemstones and furred mantles that set men of rank apart from their less fortunate brethren. Henry Fitz-Empress preferred comfort to style. Simple, unadorned tunics and high cowhide boots and mantles so short that he'd earned himself the nickname Kurt Mantle. Equally indifferent to fashion's dictates and the opinions of others, Henry dressed to please himself, and usually looked more like the king's chief huntsman than the king. To Geoffrey, who spent huge sums on his clothes, this peculiarity of his brother's was just further proof of his unfitness to be king. Henry looked even more rumpled than usual today, his short copper-coloured hair tousled and windblown, his eyes slate dark, hollowed and blood-
Sample complete. Ready to continue?